Well, we have one more minute to go, so then we can.
Okay. You don't want to look?
Yes, it has started the recording. Okay.
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I think, shall I wait another minute, Kirsten? What do you think?
Up to you.
I think
maybe a minute. It's just a quarter past now.
Yeah, right.
It's academic.
Yeah. We usually have a quarter past because we people have to start.
People have to come over for the classes that are also.
Yeah. Rapidly filling up, so that's good.
I'm scraping up a chair.
Sorry, mute on.
Must aber wieder einschalten.
We don't want it to show on the screen. Don't point it to the screen. Point it down, down, down. Yeah, maybe like that. You can push it over if it's needed. Is that good? Bill, is that good for the light on your paper? Is it the light on your paper good? Mm-hmm. Have you got enough light, or do you want a little bit more light?
Julian, shall I begin then?
Sure.
Okay, great. Welcome, everyone. We've managed to get teams going, and we've managed to all be here, which is amazing. It's my very, very, very great pleasure to welcome Professor William Lebov today. When linguists begin their careers, they very rarely think that they are going to become linguists. I mean, that's, you know, almost never happens since we don't get it in school, or we are not even told what linguistics is all about. As an undergraduate, Professor William Lebov did his degree from Harvard, and then went on to do industrial chemistry. So he was an industrial chemist for quite a long time. But fortunately for us, he came back to linguistics. And then he, since the 60s, it's been an amazing field. He was responsible for several influential studies and seminal publications in 1970. And the discipline of language variation and change, it wasn't just in North America, it was all over the world, and it rapidly spread. Even in Calcutta, which mistrusted anything modern, sociolinguistics, language variation crept in. They couldn't stop it.
There we go.
I'm not going to go on and on, because it's Bill that we want to listen to, and not me. But I would like to end with one of his best quoted maxims, and that's like, the most general and most deeply held belief about language is the golden age principle. At some time in the past, language was in a state of perfection. So nobody accepts that, you know, language changes, and it's good that it does change. So no one ever says, goodness, the way young people speak is wonderful. Now, in the midst of the pandemic, there were so many webinars, and I was invited also to take part in saying, goodness me, these words that are coming out nowadays, the usage is just dreadful. Language is changing all because of COVID. But it reminds me always of what Bill said, that every new sound will be heard as ugly. Every new expression will be heard as improper, inaccurate, and inappropriate. Given this principle, it is obvious that language change must be interpreted as non-conformity to established norms, and that people will reject changes in the structure of language when they become aware of them. And that was Bill Lebov. So enough about me. I'm going to pass the microphone on to Julian and Bill. And we have tried this out, so it's going to work. I'm sure it's going to work. So Julian, over to you.
Okay, sharing screen. screen.
Yes.
Bill, over to you.
It hasn't come in yet.
Can you see it?
No, not yet.
Okay, then. I've done something wrong. Can you hear me still? I'll try to go back to screen sharing again. Sharing. Okay, there we are. I think this is it.
Yeah, it just goes.
Now you're seeing it?
Yep, you're seeing it. That's perfect. Yes.
I want to do the slideshow. Play from current slide. Okay, now how's that? Are you seeing the title page?
That's excellent. Yes.
Oh, good. We're all good to go. All right.
Yes.
Okay, Bill, your turn. Your turn, Bill.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here back at Oxford and visiting Aditi's lab. It was 6 years ago that I was last here. And here we're following up some of the same threads. The talk I'm going to give today is a rather intricate combination of speech and recordings with the assistance of my colleague and very much very close co-worker, Julian Sankoff. But we may get mixed up at some point, in which case you'll just have to forgive us and not be too critical. One of the saddest parts of the human experience is that we don't remember it. The images of childhood fade away with a depressing certainty. The introduction of the tape recorder after World War II was not advertised as a solution to this problem when I bought my first machine in the early 1960s, the first of 6 decades of recording conversations with strangers. We began with Martha's Vineyard and my friend, documentary filmmaker, Murray Lerner. He had invited me to visit him in his summer home on the island of Martha's Vineyard. I got interested in a feature of the local dialect with words like pride and life were starting to sound like pride and belief. And decided to study the change by conducting and recording interviews with local residents. Murray advised me to scrap my little German tape recorder in favor of the $3,000 Magra 3, which he used to capture the subtleties of Isaac Perlman's violin in his Oscar-winning film From Mao to Mozart, and the contrasting styles of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan at the Newport Folk Festival. I carried it with me everywhere. I lost it in 1992 on the Paris Metro. What about the tapes? I have been told back in 1962 that the 5-inch acetate reels would be good for no more than 30 years. That early pessimism turned out to be premature. In 2012, the Vineyard recordings were still in good health. Now that they have been digitized in the Social Linguistic Archive at the University of Pennsylvania, their future is secure. We can hear what you said in 1962 with a startling clarity. The archive houses close to 1,000 social linguistic interviews that I carried out myself, along with another 10,000 recorded by fellow field workers, colleagues, research assistants, and students in my courses, the course on the study of the speech community. So here are all these recordings in this little red drive.
Right.
All in here. The question remains, what is worth remembering from this enormous pile of words? Here, the science of linguistics may be helpful in finding out which words carry the most meaning. And the science of social linguistics points towards the speakers we would most like to hear from as time goes on. In the study of languages and dialects, the subject and the investigator are generally not well known to each other. This is certainly the case with the great majority of conversations in our archive, which were initiated by linguists entering into a state of talk with people quite unknown to them, that is, strangers. For more than a year now, COVID-19 has prevented us from having such conversations with someone on the street, or else in the living room or kitchen, let alone in the home of someone we have just met. Yet we anticipate the time when we can venture out again to record the experience of others in ways that enrich our understanding of the world. Before we do, it may be helpful to review some of these older recordings and see what they have to tell us. Today's presentation will focus on four speakers from our archive. And then, first we'll hear from two men, both Americans, and then from two women, one American and one British. All were strangers to the interviewer, and we were strangers to them. Three of the four were drawn from my own exploratory interviews, and the fourth was the work of my student, Sherry Francis. We begin these studies as linguists, looking at covariation of language forms with geography, age, social status, and social meaning. In every case, conversation with a stranger opens the way to understanding of what the community wants and where it is going. In this review, we'll focus on how people use their linguistic resources to convey what they have to tell us, what we will attend to. And we will be looking at the degree of a feature known as eloquence. I'll focus on passages involving two particular kinds of eloquence. In orations, we hear bold generalizations, strengthening our belief in what we believe to be true. In narration, speakers report events that are outside of our own experience, reshaping what we believe to be possible. Listening to how people evaluate their experience as they talk about it, we come to an appreciation of their community norms as well as their rhetorical talents. Their words ring in our ears, and I hope that listening to them will bring us to a better understanding of what eloquence is. For one thing, eloquence is memorable. It would not surprise me if you find it difficult to forget them in the days that follow. Most of the publications based on linguistic interviews deal with the use of grammar and phonology as the target of inquiry. But some linguists also focus on the speaker as conversational partner. Ron McCauley has a book, Extremely Common Eloquence, in 2005. It uses the Scots dialect of working class men and women in the interviews he conducted in Ayrshire in the 1980s. The word eloquence in his title turns our attention to how well the speakers succeed in what they're trying to do for the listener. In the conversation with the strangers we'll hear from today, you will observe the speaker's convictions and evaluation of the world as they see it. You may remember much of what they have to say in the words with which they said it. You may not agree with them, but you may also find that their view of reality has become a part of yours. Granted, they were strangers, but through their command of the English language, they become people that we know, remember, and carry away with us as a part of our recognition of what can be. First, we'll hear from Donald Poole. Donald Poole was the second person I interviewed and on the island of Martha's Vineyard in 1961. He was an eighth generation descendant of Yankee whalers and fishermen. Poole was one of the key figures on the up island village of Chilmark. He was also archetypical for his generation of the sound change I was then studying, which affected the vowels of two word classes, I and ow, reversing the direction of change which had been operating since the 17th century. We refer now to this change as centralization, where the vowel of right is heard as right, but we hear many intermediate forms, as in Donald Poole's pronunciation of pride, which you will hear on the next slide. You may be most familiar with this change as Canadian raising, not only in right, but also in out and about. Results of the study of this ongoing vowel change on Martha's Vineyard were reported in my paper, The Social Motivation of a Sound Change, which was also my master's essay, and has been argued that this sound change represented a symbolic claim to local rights and privileges. In my interviews with Donald Poole and other local people, I came to realize that they were under pressure from the wealthy mainland summer people who were buying up as much desirable property as they could. Here is what Poole said.
You're going to say it. You're going to read it this time.
You see, you people who come down here to Martha's Vineyard don't understand the background of the old families of the island. Our interests run that way. Our thoughts still run that way. I'm speaking now of the descendants of the old families. Now, what we're interested in the rest of America, this part over here across the water, that belongs to you and we don't have anything to do with, has forgotten all about the maritime tradition and the fact that if it hadn't been for the interest that the early settlers of this country took in the ocean as whalemen, fishermen, and as seamen and merchant sailors, this country couldn't have existed. The Plymouth colony would have been a failure. As my interview with Donald Poole proceeded, it became clear that he was more than was a fisherman. He was a prime advocate of the importance of work as a calling and ideology. The one that Weber identified with the Protestant ethic. We talked about it. I asked him, what reason do people have to work harder than they have to earn a living? In these excerpts from Donald Poole, the noise in the background that you hear is not a defect of the tape recording, but it's actually the sound of crickets in the summer evening.
I can answer that for you, because I've already worked it up for myself and argued it before with you many minutes. The satisfaction of feeling that you have accomplished something over and above the bare necessities of life. You take a pride in doing the best that you can according to your ability. I don't have to go fishing. I can quit right now and be comfortable. But just as long as I draw the breath of life, I'll be down in my boat in the morning at 6 or 6:30 in the morning, bound somewhere, doing all that I can, as best as I can, to the best of my ability and knowledge. Because I take a pride in doing that, something I know, and I feel that I'm doing something important. And I'm happier doing that than I would be sitting around the beach. A man with a New England conscience can't sit still.
This passage has restored to Poole the order, the phonetic dimension of his rhetoric, and begins to answer the question, is speech worth saving? We do observe some instances of the phonetic variable in the words life and pride. But that is only a small contribution to the rhetorical effect. We also hear his phrasing in terms of changes of pitch, volume, and speech rate. I'll leave it to you, the audience, to judge just how much recorded speech has added to Poole's rhetorical impact. But I think you'll agree that simply reading it silently to yourself will fall short of what he achieves with his voice. How much is eloquence impaired with the loss of the original recording? I've used the conventional bold type to represent increased volume and three dots to represent a pause, which can be interpreted here as the thinking Poole put into his choice of the word important. In the passage we just heard, Poole moves to his high style, in which comparatives and superlatives are generally elaborated. Whereas the average speaker will say, as best I can, Poole elaborates this to the best of my ability and knowledge. In a less eloquent response, the adverbial clause, as long as I draw the breath of life, might have been as long as I live, or possibly as long as I breathe. The diagram shows the temporal clause, just as long as I draw the breath of life. In its structural position to the right of the main clause, it modifies. But Poole has organized his sentence here to start with this clause, just as long as I draw the breath of life. He's fronted, giving it a prominence and scope over the complex sentence that follows.
That's good.
Although in this passage, Poole refers to the rest of America. In another context, he seems to regard the vineyard as being totally separate from America. When I asked him about his schooling, he said he had been in America for a couple of years, but had returned to the island for his last 2 years of high school. As he put it,
There we are.
Well, I had a couple of years in America at a Methodist boarding school. Decided that the place for me was back where I belonged, my feet in the salt water. Been there ever since.
I passed the day on Poole's boat and had one dinner at his house. Without my tape recorder, I was incautious enough to pose him a question at the end of the meal. Mr. Poole, I said, What is a Yankee? He was silent for a good 15 seconds. Then he said, there are 10 things that make up a Yankee, and the first is the fear of a living God. I tried desperately to recall what followed, but that's all I've been able to remember. The next speaker we'll hear from today was Henry Garden, someone I interviewed almost a decade later. In the fall of 1970, I was traveling through the lower South with the idea that I might be able to interview speakers with strongly developed patterns of the local dialects of the area. I had heard that urban Atlanta had been heavily influenced by immigration from northern areas. So I decided to drive through the suburban town of East Atlanta, away from the city center. There, I saw Henry Garden, tending to his garden, a stout, gray-haired man in working clothes. I introduced myself as someone interested in the changes that were taking place in the New South. He invited me to sit down with him in his living room, and we talked for several hours. His wife and other members of the family joined in towards the end. Now, Garden was born in 1912 into a family of railroad workers. At 13, he was working for a dollar and a half a day as a water boy for his grandfather, who was section foreman. He graduated high school when he was 16 and went to work as a mechanic for the Southern Railroad, a job he felt he was born to do. He was strong in his conviction that mechanics were born, not made.
Well, you can find boards. You can send them to school for a mechanic and then go to school and work too and never be a mechanic. After going to school and studying too, they're not a mechanic. They'll get by, but they're not a mechanic.
He stayed with that company for 43 years. At the time of the interview, he was working as a foreman in the railroad yards. Now, along with Guyton's conviction that mechanics were born, not made, he also had a strong belief in premonitions of death. Like many others who do, he was aware that many others do not. In the course of the evening, I asked him, did it ever happen that someone that you knew had a feeling that something was going to happen, and it did happen? He answered positively and emphatically, thumping on his chest, it's me. I'm the one. He then gave me two accounts of how he had foreseen coming events. But these were only tests of my ability to believe what he was about to tell me. He continued.
I lost my oldest boy. He was 20 years old. Died with cancer, tumor of the brain. When he died with the cancer, I got sick. I thought I was going to die myself with the cancer. Went on there for about 6 or 8 months, and I went to every doctor. They said, ain't nothing wrong with you. So I went to bed one night. He come to me in a dream. He come home. We was talking, certainly. I just turned around to him. I said, Neil, when you going to come get me? Just like that. He said, Daddy, it's going to be a long time before I come get you. And then I got well. I'm not bothered anymore about anything. Don't worry about anything. Because that day when he tells me he's going to come get me, I know I'm ready to go. Now, if you don't believe that, you can ask my wife about that. I thought I was going to die and everybody else did too. And that's the only thing that does it. When he comes and says, I ain't come to get you for a long time, Dad. And then I got well. And I asked the beef, he let me know when he gets ready to come get me, too. I got that much faith in that dream.
Dryden indicates the extent to which he expects disbelief. Now, if you don't believe that, and the argumentative adverb, and actually believe. But the most remarkable demonstration of his linguistic commitment is seen in the complex structure of the final sentence in this narrative. Recall that Donald Poole's statement of his philosophy of hard work began with a fronted adverbial clause. As long as I draw the breath of life. Here, Henry Dryden invokes a crucial event, the time when his son will come to tell Dryden that he's ready to take him to the next world. Like Poole, he begins with an all-important temporal clause. That day, when he tell me he's going to get me, subordinate to the clause shown here on the left, I'll know I'm ready to go. The rhetorical device of fronting the temporal clause highlights that time, resolving the issue and leading Dryden to accept that his own death will be in the future a long, long time.
I mean, I'm not bothered anymore about anything, don't worry about anything, because that day when he tells me he's going to come get me, I know I'm ready to go.
Dryden's confidence in this dream is supported by the adverb actually, which reinforces assertions that are hard otherwise to accept. Here, that his beloved son will appear to him as the angel of death. The interviews examined so far have presented us with the conversation of working class men, with myself as conversational partner. We now turn to the narrative talents of two women, one on each side of the Atlantic, each with an extraordinary capacity to see through the eyes of others, and each with the rhetorical skills to match. I met Margie Knott in the summer of 1971 as I was traveling with my Nagra recorder through the Tyneside area of Northeast England. I was hoping to get some interviews with speakers of the Geordie dialect in that coal mining area. Walking through a residential area of Gateshead, I came across a group of children 9 to 12 years old, playing together on the street. I called out, "Hey kids, get over here!" And they came running. I pointed to the nearest house and I asked, "Who lives there?" The girl answered, "I do." I then walked up the steps and knocked on the door. A woman in her mid-30s answered. I told her that I wanted to interview the kids to find out about the rules for the games they play. She said, "Fine." I added that I would stop by afterwards and let her know how I made out. I spent a half hour with the kids. When I finished, I knocked on the door again, and Margie Knott came out. I told her what a good time I had talking with her daughter and her friends, and added, "Sometime when you had a few minutes, it would be good to see what it was like when you were growing up." She said, "Well, now is not a bad time." And a few minutes later, I was sitting in her living room. Her husband, Ronnie, was present too most of the time, but he didn't say a lot. 20 minutes into the interview, I asked Margie whether her neighborhood was a friendly one. I expected to he would get an answer like, oh yes, or not very. She answered, well, no neighborhood's friendly unless you assert yourself. She then supported this generalization with a saga of neighborhood conflict, which told me more about her and her neighborhood than I could have anticipated. A full version of her narrative is presented as a chapter in my 2013 Cambridge book, The Language of Life and Death. Margie's account also established her in my mind as one of the most eloquent speakers of the English language that I have met. She begins the story by establishing that she'd been friendly at first with her new neighbors.
Well, when the first moved in, I thought, well, I'll be friendly. And for a few months, we got on pretty well together. You know, that we got on very well together.
At this point, Margie brings up a first event which set off a whole series of conflicts between her and other women in the neighborhood. This was an exchange of insults between her son and the son of her neighbor. And this triggered off a more serious violation, a public complaint by the boy's mother that could be heard by anyone in the neighborhood. When Margie's neighbor comes out, she comes out into the backyard, known as the back garden.
Well, she came out, oh, and you could have heard her all over the road, you know. So, oh, well, I don't know. I'm hot-tempered, as I tell you. I mean, I don't think. I never think. I'm straight in. And I remember distinctly I had a bench full of dishes because I had just washed them all. And I went into the back garden. She was in her back garden. And I cleared the bench. She got the lot. I threw the lot. So, never mind, we couldn't get to each other.
The back garden and the row houses of Gateshead are separated by walls, as you see in this slide. So the two women couldn't get to each other. Now Margie is alert to my status as a foreigner, saying in the next segment, you'll have to translate this. Well, the fight intensifies as the women go to the front door.
She says, if I can get me hands on ye, you know, you'll have to translate this.
Yeah.
If I can get me hands on ye, you know, that's as well as the front door. When the front door was stuck into it, you see.
The women's fight at this point was inconclusive. Margie couldn't sleep that night. At this point, the majority figures come thick and fast among them. So we get Don for go, Sester for sister, May for me, Doon for Don. She owns with her coat.
I says to him, I couldn't go to bed without on my mind. I gets me coat on, I gowns up for me mate that lived up beside us, you see, when I was little. I says, are you going to come down and help me to sort this lot out? I says, there's three of them. And I says, they've nearly killed me. Oh, she owns where I caught, because she's a big lass, isn't she? She said, and my sister come down. Not that she could be much, but she come. So we get the all sitting on the stairs. It was like a boxing film. But what got me? The men never showed their faces when they all had me. Nobody come out, did they? As soon as they seen me and June coming down the street, the men to the door. Oh, we were stuck into it. There was no tomorrow. The whole street was up in arms. I never spoke to them for 3 years. It was all settled.
Margie reports that some neighbors made modest efforts to repair the breach that had lasted for years. But Margie maintained her distance. Until the next thing happened.
And then there was one day I was hanging a line in the bathroom. I hadn't spoken to anybody around here. And I knocked through a gas pipe. Well, the gas was steaming out. Well, I couldn't move my hand off the gas pipe because the gas was pouring out. I didn't know where the stop thing was for the gas. I was stuck with one leg on the bath and one on the windowsill with my hand off the gas thing. But the thing was, if I hadn't gone out... But never mind, they were in the garden. And one of them happened to look up and she says, "Are you in trouble, Margaret?" I says, "Not really, I've just heard a gas main." Well, she came in and she turned the gas off. And I came downstairs and she just sat down and you'd just think it had never been.
Everything was...
It was forgotten, wasn't it? And then, of course, we had the man who died. Our husband died over here. And we've been friendly ever since. And even now she'll say, "I don't know why it all started."
And we have finally Margie Knott's eloquent summation.
Sorry, that's fine. Here it is.
But the thing was, if I hadn't gone out and defended myself when I did, well, my life just wouldn't have been worth living. You've got to go out and defend yourself, because if you don't, well, you might as well be dead. That's all there is to it, you know.
As in many other fight stories in our archive, Margie's narrative unfolds as a series of short, rapid-fire clauses that build the tension along with the phonology, intonation, and lexical features of the vernacular. But she arrives at an evaluation of these events in terms of her own philosophy of living with two fronted hypotheticals. If I hadn't gone, defended herself when I did. And if you don't, you might as well be dead.
The thing was, if I hadn't gone out and defended myself when I did, well, my life just wouldn't have been worth living. You've got to go out and defend yourself, because if you don't, well, you might as well be dead.
We return now to my own city of Philadelphia, where our last speaker's narrative evokes Donald Poole's fierce loyalty to the place where he lived. This is Gloria Steinem. As I argued, Poole's language reflected his claim to local rights and privileges. Our Philadelphian speaker, Gloria Steinem, was moved to tell the story of her mother's claim to live in a place where she was denied such rights and privileges, facing hostility and violence. Gloria Steinem is a 66-year-old black woman interviewed in 1981 by Sherry Francis, then a graduate student in Linguistics 560, my course on the study of the speech community. In 1925, when Gloria was only 10 years old, she lived through an event that is preserved in chilling detail in her memory. In the events of this story, we see how the abilities of a 10-year-old and her mother are tested against the united front of the most powerful forces in our society, the community, the police, and the police administration. It is a repeated struggle against overwhelming odds. The central figure, Gloria Steinem's mother, is a person of extraordinary persistence, courage, and ingenuity. On the night her family moved into a white neighborhood, Gloria was alone with her younger siblings. The neighbors stoned the house.
Well, no sooner did my mother get out of the house than... oh, such an awful crash came through the window, and I looked, and there was a big stone.
She told the children to hide and ran to find her mother, who located a police captain.
My mother said to the captain, "What are you going to do about it?" And he says, "Well, lady, there's nothing we can do about it." So anyhow, she said to him, "Well, I know one thing you can do." And he said, "What's that?" She says, you can take me home. She said, take you home? She said, yes, in the police patrol. They put us in the police patrol, and they took us home.
Now, Gloria's mother realized that the clamor of the police patrol bell, clang, 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 would bring out the whole neighborhood, which it did. And Gloria remembers that sound when she tells the story.
Well, this police patrol, that bell they had, it went clang, clang, clang. And all the neighbors came running out to see what was happening. And when we got out of that police patrol, before the patrol ever left, my mother turned and faced all of those people that were standing around. And she says, why you're doing this to me, I don't know. She says, I know that I am different from you, color-wise. But in every other respect, I'm just the same as you are. And all I'm trying to do is provide a home for my family. She says, it is wintertime and it is cold, and I cannot afford to be buying windows. You know, she said, whoever threw the stones, I don't know, but you can all see what has happened. And now I'm telling you that we're going to be here for a month. So you might just as well make up your mind to that. If you don't want me here, then you people get together and give me enough money to move somewhere else because I do not have it.
Gloria's mother's speech plainly had a strong effect on the neighbors. The logic of a physician is strengthened by the use of WH extraction on two crucial causes. As we see in this slide, the WH cause, why you're doing this, the object of I don't know, is fronted in the first part of her oration to the neighbor. With this second case, the parallelism adds strength to her rhetoric in that whoever threw the stone is also the object of I don't know. By the end of the story, we're told that the neighbors did back down and Gloria's family stayed in the neighborhood until the death of her father a year or so later.
During the period of time that we were there, my father became sick, and the neighbors were as nice as anybody could ever have been.
The parallels between the stories told by Gloria Stein and Margie Knott are quite striking, both in content and in the rhetorical devices that they use. In both cases, the conflict began when a new family moved into the neighborhood, and in both, it was resolved by the death of a father figure. In Gloria's case, her actual father, and in Margie's case, the husband of one of the neighbors who had been her antagonist.
You'd just think it had never been.
Everything was...
It was forgotten, wasn't it? And then, of course, we had the man who died. Our husband died over here. And we've been friendly ever since.
Both women use hypothetical if as their major grammatical tool. This slide shows the fronting of the important hypothetical, if you don't want me here, as the condition for the rest of the complex sentence at the end of Gloria's voicing of her mother's speech in the neighbors. We noted earlier the two instances of WH extraction by Gloria of whoever and why to strengthen her rhetoric and assert the logic of her position. In Margie's case, she embeds her complaint about the lack of support from the men in the street under what got me, in a passage where the female protagonists are the heroines. When the men saw her and her friend June coming down the street, they retreated behind their doors.
But what got me? Their men never showed their faces when they all had me. Nobody come out, did they? As soon as they see me and June coming down the street, the men to the door.
As in Margie Knott's narrative, the chief polarization of participants in Gloria Steinem's narrative runs along gender lines. The males are passive, undependable, indecisive. The females are active, dependable, decisive. At the beginning, the protagonist is 10-year-old Gloria, who takes whatever action is possible. She is then replaced as protagonist by her mother, who exemplifies these attributes to a remarkable degree. The epic quality of this extended narrative is underlined by the many obstacles placed in her way. She has to deal with the hostile neighbors, an undependable husband, a useless and prejudiced policeman, and a police captain who was programmed to avoid responsibility. Her determination and ingenuity find a path to neutralizing, if not overcoming, these cumulative threats to her and her family. Knowing in advance that the clamor of the police wagon would bring the crowd of neighbors to the open, she was able to replace the hidden, anonymous opposition with one that she could confront directly. In conclusion, we've heard four speakers of the English language, each strangers to me, on central issues of their life experience, aware that they would be projected to a broader audience who might well disagree with them on the central issues. In their interviews, they drew upon the resources of the language to support their conviction that these were important matters. And they left no doubt about what they believed and felt about them. These speakers' words have rung in my ears across the decades as eloquent, memorable, and convincing, each in their own particular ways. Working class speakers, none with a college education, they do not yield to any in their command of the English language. I'll now let you hear each speaker again, at a moment when they summoned up the rhetorical resources of the language. Since we will be hearing them, we can observe the ways in which intonation, the rise and fall of the voice, and their distinct phrasing operate as a signpost to the issues of central importance in their lives.
All that I can, as best as I can.
But I got that much faith in that dream.
If I hadn't gone out and defended myself when I did.
If you don't want me here, then you people get together.
These are the voices of strangers. They are taken from exploratory interviews which precede quantitative analysis. These are the first steps for understanding, which begins, as always, by listening to what people have to say.
That's it.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you very much indeed. Do you want to stop sharing the screen so you can see if people have questions?
Okay. Just have to remind myself how to do that.
Oh, it's the little square thing that you press again and then
go back into that square thing.
That's right. So
again, stop sharing the screen. Okay.
That was enthralling, as I think your son said. That was wonderful. Thank you so much, Bill. Now, time for questions. If you could please press the hand button I will be able to see it on the participant list, and then I'll call on you. So, JC is using the clap button, but yes, we'll clap properly after we've had the questions. Any questions, please?
Jace, I have a question.
Your hand button, though, or something to indicate that you want to ask questions. No one at all? Dead silence? Everybody is struck dumb. No, I don't see any hands at least. Yeah. Roz, yes, please. Rosalind Temple.
Yes, I'm sorry, I've got an overlively puppy trying to get my attention at the same time as asking the question. So all these data, when do we stop? Because it's really striking that you're going right back to look at the individuals right back at the beginning. Do we just go on forever collecting data? So this is a very general and vague question, but I hope it makes sense.
Well, I would just like to mention that unfortunately Bill has lost a hearing aid in the last days. So I'm going to repeat the questions very loudly for him to hear, because that's just a technical problem we're going to be seeing about tomorrow. So Rosalind asked, when do we stop collecting all this data? Should we just go on forever? You yourself in this speech went back to some of your earliest work. The idea is, do we just go on forever? Is that a good version of your question?
Yes, it is. And by the way, it was an amazing pleasure to hear. Sorry. Amazing to hear the early data as well. It's absolutely fascinating knowing the literature. But yeah, that's the question.
It was amazing to hear those early voices. And so surprising to us who thought, you know, that those tapes wouldn't last. So what do you say, Bill?
Well, we have the fact of language change. That language doesn't stay still, and that we can always follow along with this change of the language. But I think that it's a good question in the light of what I discover when I teach a course on narrative and say to the children they should go up and ask their grandparents questions like these. If there's one thing that happened in your life which you'd never forget, what would it be? And they come back to me with the same question. They say, how come they never told me this before? The richness of human experience is unlimited.
We have another question from JC.
JC, if you could speak nice and loudly, that would help.
Sorry, no, I had my microphone turned off. Is that better?
Yes.
Yes, good, right. Bill, thanks very much for that. I enjoyed it greatly. I know you've done work on the people who lead linguistic change, and I imagine that not all the people you interviewed speak as eloquently and as elegantly as the people that you played us. Is there a correlation, do we know, between people's rhetorical abilities, if you like, and the likelihood that they will be in the vanguard of change, that they will be the leaders, that people will model themselves on them?
Well, these people with these wonderful rhetorical skills, are they likely to be the leaders of change? Is it likely that people will model themselves on speakers like these? Or are the people who are leaders of change maybe not so rhetorically elegant and eloquent?
Well, here we come to the contribution to this field of one of my oldest students, Fanny Eckert, who now is just in California, who has continued to explore this study of language change. with the concept of social meaning, that we do have a continual development of change under the impetus of the leaders of social issues, where the language change is really a subtle aspect of the development of the individual creature, but that in your studies of social meaning, she finds that the pattern that is discovered was illustrated by Donald Poole was paradigmatic for the social meaning of language change everywhere. So this, what she calls the third wave approach, takes Donald Poole explicitly as a paradigmatic type.
Yeah, thanks.
As I if I could just jump in for a second, as I remember, you found that Donald Poole, for his age, was quite advanced. I mean, there were younger people who were farther advanced in that change than he was, but as in his age group, he was advanced. So one would think he was an advanced speaker, sure of change, over the decades of his own life.
Yeah.
I think. Is that right? Is that not true?
Yes.
Gillian, your video has turned itself off.
Oh, no. And my tech support has just left. Oh, dear.
Now I see your little circle. Yes.
It's fine for me. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I can still see them. No problem.
I can see them.
Yeah, I can see them.
Oh, maybe I don't have
the sound. Okay, good.
I don't know.
Never mind. So, Damien, Ms. Damien Hall is the next question, please.
Thank you, Aditi, and thank you, Bill. That was wonderful. Thank you, Gillian, also. It's great to see you both.
Thank you.
My question is,
you what too, do you by the way.
Thank you very much. What do you think, if you can say, is the most important contribution that all of this wonderful work has done? I've really enjoyed listening just for what these people have said, what they meant. So we've all benefited greatly from the work over the last six decades that you've mentioned in the linguistic sense. But is that more important than these life lessons? Mm-hmm. You've written books about both, after all.
What do you think is the most important in your own work, the linguistic analysis of grammatical and phonological structure, or these kind of life lessons that these great people are telling us? Well, Damien,
that's a question that I have asked myself very frequently, and I don't have the answer to it, because I wrote a fair amount of poetry when I was coming up, and in recent decades, where I'm expressing some of the same kinds of feelings that I've drawn from the people I've interviewed. So, if we ask yourself, what are we up to? My answer to this is almost the same as I give my students who ask me, what should I be doing? My answer is, if you reach the age of 70 and you feel you haven't wasted your time, that will be sufficient.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Do we have any further questions? If not, Bill, can I ask a question? I noticed in the four speeches you had, there was obviously a lot of interaction with the intonational phrasing, as well as, let's say, the WH fronting and the syntactic structure. And they all had beautiful intonational contours with risers, etc. But not everybody has these, so there can be also languages, not necessarily who have were quite flat in their, and even in their questions, they do not necessarily rise. To what extent do you think the intonation and the sentence structure interact in terms of change?
Shall I repeat that, Bill? Mm-hmm. He said, to what extent do you think, you know, intonation, it can be quite variable, both in between speakers and different languages who have, some of which have quite flat intonation, even in questions. So do you think that there is a relationship between intonation and sentence structure in conveying meanings? Is that good enough, Aditi?
Yes, and if which one he thinks that language change, contributes to more or less effects on language change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which more or less affects language change?
Feel that I have neglected to large extent the study of intonation, and on January 1st of each year, I find myself making a new resolution. This is the year I'm really going to understand intonation. Get a number of people have done so. So when I first began the study of linguistic variation, the task was to find linguistic variables which were most amenable to quantitative analysis. And it turned out that vowel systems have been the leaders in this field, and that the technical apparatus for analyzing vowels quantitatively along three or four dimensions has led other fields. So the FAVE program at Penn has been used throughout the world now, by allowing you to sit down and in 2 weeks do what used to take for 3 months.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I used the same Niagara tape recorder you had to do my first intonation studies, and they were very reliable indeed. Do we have any further questions? I mean, Bill has been sitting and talking for a full hour, so perhaps one more question, and then we give him a rousing hand, if possible, with our little gadget, or not a gadget, whatever you call this, the symbol that JC was using. Any further question, though? I don't want to just cut it short. This has been an amazing experience, Bill. This for us has really made the pandemic viable. having you over here. Anything else? Any comments? Any questions? We have recorded this, so we should be able to play it back again, which is wonderful. And Bill would be able to see it back again as well.
Well, if I may just make a last comment, I would like to say thank you for inviting Bill. It's been great fun for me listening to some of these people who I've heard some of before, but not all. And just to think of ourselves as being, you know, in your community, we do remember our trip to Oxford so fondly. So we hope we'll get to see you in reality.
Yes, 2015 is long ago. Yes.
Very much.
Having you. Thank you so much, Jillian, and thank you so much. Thank you for a wonderful, wonderful talk. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. I'll get back to you, Jillian, later. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye. Thank you, Professor.